dog. I know a dancer that'll teach you to kick. Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Hi, Eric Marcus here with the Making Gay History podcast. Each week we take a deep dive into my stack of decades-old audio cassettes to share with you the voices of LGBTQ history. In our first episode, you'll meet Sylvia Rivera. She was an iconic trans activist who also happened to be at Stonewall in 1969, June 28th, the night of the big uprising. I'll never forget seeing Sylvia for the first time. I was standing in the entry hall of her tenement building in a small river town in New York. And she was standing at the top of a rickety staircase in the glare of a bare light bulb. She had these really strong features, high cheekbones, wide-spaced eyes, gap-toothed smile. She was wearing red lipstick. She was wearing this outfit that my sister would have worn in the 1970s if she'd had the guts. It was a black halter top tied at the waist over a skin-tight black undershirt and hot pink spandex pants tucked into beige knee-high boots with chunky heels. And I don't know if it was the combination of her face, her makeup, her hair, or her outfit, or the light, but she scared the shit out of me. I was wearing an orange down parka and green corduroys, and I looked like I'd stepped off the F train from Queens, which is where I'm from. So I caught my breath, climbed the stairs, and Sylvia welcomed me into her steamy kitchen. The windows were all fogged. She introduced me to her boyfriend, who was the most nondescript guy you can imagine, especially next to Sylvia. And sitting in a chair off to the side was her friend Rennie, who was Sylvia's butch opposite. Flat top haircut, lumberjack shirt, overalls, work boots. A pot of chili was cooking on the stove. There was a bottle of vodka on the table that was almost empty. I don't remember now if she offered me a drink or not, but I have what I call Jewish liver syndrome, and a teaspoon of vodka would leave me on the floor, not Sylvia. So I got myself situated. I clipped the microphone onto Sylvia's halter top, and I set my recorder to record. Now, on this tape, you'll hear me call Sylvia Ray, which was the name she was going by at the time.
Interview with Ray Rivera, Saturday, December 9th, 1989, at 4 p.m. Location is the home of Ray Rivera in Tarrytown, New York. Interviewer is Eric Marcus. Tape one, side one.
The Stonewall wasn't a bar for drag queens. Everybody keeps saying it was. Mm-hmm. So this is where I get into arguments with people. They say, oh, no, it's always a drag queen bar, and it was a black bar. No. Washington Square Bar mm-hmm. was the drag queen bar. Okay, you could get into the Stonewall if they knew you. And there were only a certain amount of drag queens that were allowed into the Stonewall at that time. We had just come back in from Washington, my first lover and I. We were passing forged checks okay. and whatnot, but we were making good money. I said, well, let's go to Stonewall. Let's do our thing. Let's go there, you know. Actually, it was the first time that I had even been to freaking Stonewall. I wasn't in full drag. I was dressed, you know, very pleasantly. But I was wearing a woman's suit. bell bottoms were out then. I had made this fabulous suit at home, and I was wearing that, and I had the hair out. Lots of makeup, lots of hair.
Were you drinking at the bar or just standing around?
No, I was drinking. The police came in. They came in to get their pay off, as usual. They would come in, padlock the freaking door. As soon as they left, the mafia was there, cutting in the door. They had a new register. They had more money and they had more booze. This is what we learned to live with at that time. We had to live with it.
Right.
We had to live with it until that day. I don't know if it was the customers or was the police. It just, everything clicked. Everybody just like, why the fuck are we doing all this for? The people at some bars, especially at Stonewall, were involved in other movements, and everybody just like, all right, we got to do our thing. We're going to go for it. And when they ushered us out, it was nice, you know, when they just very nicely put you out the door, and then you're standing across the street and showing the square park, and but why? All of a sudden you just feel this. Everybody's looking at each other, but why do we have to keep on constantly putting up with this? And the nickels, the dimes, the pennies, and the quarters started flying.
Why that? Why do people do that?
The payoff. That was the payoff.
Oh, oh.
That was the payoff.
It was to symbolize the payoff.
Yeah. You already got...
Here's some more?
And here's some more. To be there, you know, it's just like... Oh, it was so beautiful. I just like, you know, it's just like...
Was it exciting?
Oh, it was so exciting. It was like, ow, we're doing it. We're doing it. We're fucking their nerves. The cops were, you know, they just panicked. Inspector Pine really panicked.
Mm-hmm.
He really did.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he had no backup.
Mm-hmm.
He did not expect any of the retaliation that the gay community gave him at that point.
Do you think all this was in part because people were so angry for so long?
People were very angry for so long. I mean, how long can you live in a closet? I was already out of my closet. When you're obvious back then, there was nothing to hold you back. It was always the effeminate male or the butch woman. That's what society always looked like. We are the ones that went out there and we didn't take no shit from them. We didn't have nothing to lose. Actually, you know, at that point in time, you know, I understand the ones that held their heads down low because they probably had very nice jobs and they had a family to go to. I was born to be an effeminate child. My grandmother used to come home and find me all dressed up. It's just like, I get my ass whipped. Of course, you know, well, we don't do this. You're one of the boys. I want you to be a mechanic.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, but I want to be a hairdresser. I want to do this. And I want to wear these clothes. I was born July 2nd, 1951. At 2:30 in the morning, in a taxi cab, in the old Lincoln Hospital parking lot. The old queen couldn't wait. She says, oh, I'm ready to hit the streets. My grandmother used to always joke about that. I said, yeah. I said, you see why I'm always standing out on the street corner? That's good. And then I came out feet first.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, so you landed on a...
So I was ready. I always mention my grandmother because my mother died when I was 3 years mm-hmm. old, and she raised me. Mm-hmm. So it's my grandmother that raised me until I left home.
Right. So you left home at 10?
Yeah. I left home about 10, 10 and a half. I was almost 11. You know, the only reason that I left home at such an early age was because my grandmother came home crying one day. With the tears in her eyes, they're calling you a pato, which means faggot.
Mm-hmm.
In the Spanish language. And it hurt her so bad because they were doing this to me, and she knew where I was coming from. She even knew. I had that much respect for my grandmother. I didn't want her to suffer. It wasn't my suffering. I was worrying about her suffering.
How did you survive on the street?
You became a street walker. You stand out on the street and you make money.
At that age?
At that age, it was easy to make money. I don't know how many times my grandmother had to come and bail me out of jail. She was there. She always came, bailed me out. She says, oh, that's my grandson. I have to take him out.
What were you in jail for?
Prostitution, you know, bullshit, loitering. Nothing major, you know. If you walk down 42nd Street and even looked like a faggot, you were going to jail.
So you went to jail a few times?
Oh, I went to jail a lot of times. The community is always embarrassed by drag queen.
Why do you think?
Why do I think? Yeah. No, it's not why I think, I know.
Okay, why do you know?
Because straight society always looks, oh, well, a faggot always dresses in drag, or he's too effeminate. You got to be who you are. Mm-hmm. Passing is like saying a light-skinned black woman or black male passing for white. And I refused to pass.
You couldn't have passed?
No, I couldn't have passed.
Not in this lifetime?
No, not in this lifetime. I just like being myself.
Right.
It's fun being Sylvia. It's fun playing the game.
This interview was the only time I ever talked to Sylvia, and I'm sorry that I never did again. I wish I had. In the years that followed, Sylvia struggled with addiction and homelessness, and she died on February 19, 2002. She was 51. When I interviewed Sylvia, she talked about how old she was and how young I was. She said she was 39 at the time. I think she was actually 38, and I was 31. I'm nearly 60. And now, looking back at her age when she died, 51, she seems so young. I'd like to thank our brilliant executive producer, Sarah Birmingham, our wonderfully fussy audio engineer, Casey Holford, our exquisite composer, Fritz Meyer. Thank you also to Hannah Moak, our social media guru, and our masterful webmaster, Jonathan Dozier-Ezel. We had production assistance from the incredibly talented Jenna Weiss-Berman, whose enthusiasm for this project made it possible. The Making Gay History podcast is a co-production of Pineapple Street Media with funding from the Arcus Foundation, which is dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org. And if you like what you've heard, please subscribe to the Making Gay History podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes on our website at makinggayhistory.com. So long, until next time.
Ring, 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 CKUT. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding, CKUT 90.3. Take it from me. It's the best, beats the rest. 90.3 CKUT.
Oshiega 2022, Montreal's beloved outdoor festival, announces its full lineup February 21st. Let us know your favorite act to be entered into a draw for a pair of three-day passes. Comment on social media or call the studio line at 514-448-4013 and leave a message to be entered into the draw. We'll be drawing three names. Enter before Thursday, February 24th at 5 p.m. to win.
Hi, History Makers. Eric here. If you love the stories we've shared and want to help us bring you more, I hope you'll join with hundreds of other donors and make a tax-deductible contribution to Making Gay History. Now's an especially great time to donate, because if we can raise $50,000 with your help, that amount will be doubled thanks to challenge grants from the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation and Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. Please help us unlock the $50,000 in matching funds. Go to makinggayhistory.com and click on the donate button. That's makinggayhistory.com and click on the donate button. Thanks. I'm Eric Marcus, and welcome to the third season of Making Gay History. Just as I did for our first two seasons, I'm taking a deep dive into my decades-old audio archive to bring you the voices of LGBTQ history. For the start of this new season, we're bringing you the second part of a conversation I had with Sylvia Rivera back in 1989. Sylvia talked about her memories of the Stonewall Uprising and how she left home in 1962 when she was only 11 years old. If you haven't already heard that episode, I urge you to have a listen. So here's the second part of that conversation in Sylvia's tenement apartment kitchen in North Tarrytown, New York. It's Saturday evening, December 9th, 1989. Sylvia's friend Rennie has just left for work. On Rennie's way out, she asked Sylvia to save her a drink for when she gets back. Sylvia promises that of course she would, but as soon as Rennie is out the door, Sylvia pours herself another generous glass of vodka from a bottle that is already well on the way to being emptied. Sylvia's boyfriend Frank is in the next room watching TV.
Frank, what are you doing? I just realized you have to go and buy me some tomato sauce. I forgot to buy the tomato sauce for the chili. So could you go out and get that? And, huh?
One jar.
Pick up a couple cans, you know. Yeah, nice Aunt cans, Millie. Not the little ones.
Yeah, the jars.
No, not Aunt Millie's. I need tomato sauce. We're not making pasta.
Oh, okay.
But no, it's, you can sell anything out on the streets. You can sell men, young boys, and young women. There's always a customer out there, and they are the ones that are sick. I remember just going home and just scrubbing myself in a tub of hot water. Oh, these people touched me. I mean, they're sleaze. Even if they weren't old, they could have been young. I remember sleeping, when I was 13 and 14 years old, I remember sleeping with guys that were 20 and 21 because they were paying me. And they had their hang-ups.
You knew what you were.
I knew I was a whore at that time. I knew I was out to make money.
And these guys were pretending they were something else coming to you for...
They came for a fantasy trip. Uh-huh. That's what it was. It was a big fantasy.
So how did the police treat you during when you were a kid and out on the streets?
The first time that I got arrested, I was like, I'm going where?
What had you done?
You were a faggot.
Were you dressed in women's clothes?
Well, back then, when I first started out, I was in women's clothes. It was what they call right now, even right now, what I'm wearing is scare drag.
Scare drag?
Mm-hmm.
What is scare drag?
What I'm wearing right now. You don't have the tits on or anything. You just have a little makeup on. You have your hair out. You got women's clothing on. And that's what they call scare drag. Every time that I used to go in front of a judge, upper head female impersonation.
That was the charge?
Yeah.
Upper head female impersonation. In other words... From the neck up.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
The laws back then were very strange. Mm-hmm.
So from, let's say, up until 69, you weren't involved in gay rights or any of that stuff, were you?
Before the Stonewall, I was involved in the Black Liberation Movement, the peace movement. I just felt that I had the time, and I knew that I had to do something. And then when the Stonewall happened...
You were, let's say, you were 18 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
You were still a kid by most standards.
Yes. It was like, a God sent thing to me. I mean, I just happened to be there when it all jumped off. I said, oh, well, great. I said, now is my time. I said, here, I'm out there being a revolutionist for everybody else. I said, now it's time to do my thing for my own people. And I joined TAA. And that first year that we were petitioning for gay rights, on April 15th, of that year.
So it was 1970?
It was 1970.
Yeah.
I got arrested for petitioning for gay rights on 42nd Street.
You had a petition, was it for the
yes.
City Gay Rights Bill?
The City Gay Rights Bill.
Who were you getting to sign it?
I was asking people to sign in the middle of 42nd Street.
Yeah. Were you dressed in drag?
No, I was dressed casually, mm-hmm. makeup, you know, the mm-hmm. hair and whatnot.
It's hair drag.
The cops came up to me and says, no, you can't do this. This is either you leave or we're going to arrest you. I said, well, fine, arrest me. They very nicely picked me up and threw me in a police car and took me to jail.
For taking out a petition?
Yep. I went in front of the judge. Judge spoke to arresting officers. He's like, don't you realize what's going on? You know, I could see his look in his face. Well, number one, I says, I'm letting him go.
He's a policeman.
Mm-hmm. He says, you don't realize what you just did. He says, the whole country is going up in an uproar and you are messing with people.
For
you're right. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Now, were you part of, there was a protest at NYU?
One of the sit-ins. I was one of the sit-ins. We always had dances there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they didn't want us to have any dances there. It's okay. We won't have any dances. We just took over Weinstein Hall. It was a nice sit-in for 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting.
So you were there?
Yeah, I was there. Mm-hmm. And my brothers and sisters from the gay community themselves were not very, very supportive.
Of you?
Of anything that went down. At that time, I was sleeping in the park because I had already given up my job, given up everything for gay liberation. I was sleeping in Sherman Square Park, okay? And Bob Kohler came and told me, he says, we're having a sit-in. He was from DLF. He's one of the originators from Gay Liberation. Mm-hmm. And the people that held that sit-in in for 3 days was my people, the people from STAR. We were there. And everybody says, oh, it's because you didn't have a place to live. But that wasn't true. We could have picked up a trick and stayed at a hotel. But we were there for them, Marsha, myself, and everybody else. I mean, when they came in and threw us out, there was nobody there except what they call the street people or the STAR people.
Was STAR formed already by then?
Actually, STAR was born out of the NYU sit-in.
What does STAR mean?
Street Transvestite Action Revolutionary.
What was the reason for starting it?
My brothers and sisters kept on using us.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to be by ourselves.
Yeah, how many queens were involved in STAR? Was it a small group?
It was a very small. It was myself, Marsha Johnson, Bambi Lamore, and Dora.
Uh-huh.
I had like several women in there. Okay, wait a minute.
So it's maybe a half dozen.
Yeah, half dozen. BB. BB was part of my group at one time.
Did you ever testify at City Hall with BB?
Oh.
Tell me about that. I've heard stories.
Woo! And Miss June Bartel. I think it must have been the first time that we went. And, you know, I gave my point of view. And B got up and gave her point of view. And then after that, you know, said, well, we'll play cool, you know. We went to the ladies' room. Well, actually, yeah, we went to the ladies' room. They wouldn't let us in.
This is the police.
Yes. It's okay. We won't go in there. We'll just go into the men's room. And we went to the men's room. We came out. We, you know, fell out, you know, in a little line. And I forget the councilman's name. He says, and why should I have my children being taught by them? Men that dress in women's clothing. Now here, Bibi is going to become a teacher. Okay? And we're like, what is this man's problem? He just like really put us down. So June comes out of the bathroom and she walks right in front of the council table. She says, well, where the fuck do you want me to go and take a piss at? You want me to take my pants down right here and piss in front of you? And she's standing there with this little mini and she pulls up the mini and there's the G-string standing on and they're like freaked out. Here's June like, you know, they're like, oh my God, he's going to show it? Is it real? And she's... And June, very nice, says, oh, well, I guess we have to leave now. And she just pulled back her clothes on and says, now, tell me where I can go piss. No, but I did testify. I testified a couple of times. Mm-hmm. The gay rights bill, as far as I'm concerned, you know, to me, the gay rights bill and the people that I worked with on the gay rights bill, and when I did all the petitioning and whatnot, when the bill was passed, that bill was mine as far as I'm concerned. I helped word it, and I worked very hard for it. And that's why I get upset when I give interviews and whatnot, because fucking community has no respect for the people that really did it. Drag queens did it. We did it for our own brothers and sisters, but damn it, don't keep shoving us in the fucking back and stabbing us in the back, and that's what really hurts. And it is very upsetting.
It's not only do you get beaten up by straights, you get beaten up by the gays.
You get beaten up by your own, and that's what hurts. Mm-hmm. Marsh and I fought a lot for the liberation of our people. We did a lot back then. Marsh and I had a building on 2nd Street, which is called Star House. And when we asked the community to help us, there was nobody to help us. We were nothing. We were nothing. And now we were taking care of kids that were younger than us. I mean, Marsha and I were young, and we were taking care of them. And GAA had teachers and lawyers, and all we asked them was, well, if you could help us teach our own so we can all become a little bit better, there was nobody there to help us.
They left you.
They left us hanging. There was only one person that came and helped us. Once again, Bob Cole was there. He helped us paint. He helped us put wires together. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing. I mean, we took a building that was, a slum building. And we tried. We really did. We went out and made that money off the streets to keep these kids off the street.
So you sold yourselves to take care of the kids?
Instead of showing them what we were doing. Because mm-hmm. We already went through it.
But you wanted to protect them? What were you protecting them from?
From the world, from life in general. Just about, you know, to show them that there was a better life.
Who were these other kids, the young ones? Where'd they come from?
From everywhere. We had kids from Boston, California, everywhere. We had them.
Where were their families?
I guess at home.
These were kids like you who had to leave.
They were good kids. Mm-hmm. I've seen a couple of them. After, you know, the movement and whatnot, and they were all, the ones that I've seen, they've done very well. Mm-hmm. And it makes you feel good.
Yeah, but if you got in your way, you would have had a building where kids could come and...
I would have loved to have had to be honest with you, like every time I see the commercial covered in the house, I said, I would have loved to have had that. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have seen that. Mm-hmm. A star house mm-hmm. for the children, mm-hmm. for people that know, you know, these kids already knew. You always get that feeling, mm-hmm. you know, you're different, mm-hmm. so go somewhere.
So they came here. But you needed the help of, I would imagine you and Marsha did not have the resources, the experience.
We just didn't have any monies. And we
needed really, the help of GIA.
We needed the monies from the community, and mm-hmm. the community was not going to help us.
I got two
pages. Oh, you did? Good. Yeah, let me finish this chili, and then I'll make the rice. You get the can opener, it's all the way over there.
Yeah, Sophie, is there anything that I haven't asked you, any story, anything that you'd like to, that I should know?
I'd like to do a lot more for the movement. The movement just doesn't want to deal with me.
Sylvia's dream of a safe place for LGBTQ youth came to an end when she and Marsha were evicted from the derelict building that was home to Star House. But later that decade, in 1979, Dr. Emery Hetrick and his life partner Damian Martin founded the Institute for the Protection of Lesbian and Gay Youth. It's now called HMI, and you can learn more about that organization in Making Gay History's Season 2 in Joyce Hunter's episode. I wish I could say that in the years after I first met Sylvia, she lived happily ever after in North Tarrytown with her boyfriend. But her friend and partner in the movement, Marsha P. Johnson, died in 1992, and Sylvia's life went off the rails. She wound up homeless and living on an abandoned pier near Greenwich Village. Sylvia eventually stopped drinking and rejoined the movement, and in 2001 even tried to restart STAR, renaming it Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries. But she died of liver cancer a year later. Sylvia was 50 years old. I've got a few people to thank for this first episode of Season 3, including our executive producer, Sarah Burningham, and audio engineer, Ann Pope. We had production assistance from Josh Gwynn. Our theme music was composed by Fritz Myers. Thank you also to social media strategist, Will Coley, our webmaster, Jonathan Dozer-Ezel, and researchers, Bronwyn Partis and Zachary Seltzer. Our guiding light since the very first episode is Jenna Weiss-Berman. The Making Gay History podcast is a co-production of Pineapple Street Media with assistance from the New York Public Library's Manuscripts and Archives Division and One Archives at the USC Libraries. Season 3 of this podcast is made possible with funding from the Ford Foundation, which is on the front lines of social change worldwide. So long, until next time.
Sounds, tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT. Bye.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
I'm Eric Marcus, and this is a special bonus episode of Making Gay History. The sixth season of our podcast has focused on LGBTQ activism in the post-Stonewall 70s. Two of the most prominent trans activists to emerge out of that period were Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. In 1970, the year after the Stonewall Uprising in New York City's Greenwich Village, the two friends founded Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, or STAR, and set up a bare-bones refuge in a rundown apartment building on the Lower East Side of Manhattan for street kids much like themselves. They called it Star House. In December 1970, Liza Cowan, a 20-year-old reporter for WBAI Radio, conducted what we believe is the oldest recorded interview with Sylvia, Marsha, and other members of Star. She used a reel-to-reel tape recorder and set out to do a story on what was then known as cross-dressing. Eventually, a single reel containing an edited version of the interview found its way into the basement of the Lesbian Her Story Archives in Brooklyn, New York. And that's where Making Gay History's self-described archive rat, Brian Faree, found it in the spring of 2019. Before we share some of that incredibly rare tape with you, I thought I'd ask Brian about his experience of discovering this long-lost interview. How did you find this tape? Where were you and what were you doing?
So I was looking for audio for the fifth season of Making Gay History for our Stonewall season. And my mission was to find archival audio tapes that were made around 1968 to 1971. So I went to the LGBT Center archives. I went to the New York Public Library. And I went to the Lesbian Her Story archives. In the basement of the Lesbian Her Story archives, I was going through all of their cassettes for WBAI shows. I didn't find anything that reached back that was applicable to what we were looking for. But out of the corner of my eye in the basement, I saw a box of open reel audio, which is an older style of audio recording than cassettes would be.
So what is, can you describe what open reel recording is? Is it what you see in the movies or in photographs, an actual reel of tape?
Yes, these are the big reels. These are like, well, 3-inch, 5-inch, 7-inch, 10-inch. And I didn't know what was in this box when I saw it, but I went upstairs to the volunteer archivist, Rachel Corbin, and I asked her if I could go through it. And right there in the middle of the box, I pulled out this recording that was labeled Star. I was afraid to open it because some of these tapes, they're so fragile when they're 50, 60, 70 years old. They are so fragile that you can destroy them. And I know how difficult it is to get archival material surrounding Star.
Yeah. So what did you, when you saw this, besides being afraid that you could possibly damage the tape, I mean, it's almost like finding the Holy Grail.
You know, you want to listen to it immediately when you find a tape like that, and you can't.
Why couldn't you just play it?
Well, for one, there are some tapes that as you play it, they will erase when they're 50 years old. So you will listen to it, but nobody else will.
So if you want to have a tape digitized like that, what do you do?
We took the tape to a studio in Harlem called Swan Studios that specializes in this type of digitization. I took so much care when I took it out of that building. I was so afraid of damaging it. It was like I had $10,000 in my backpack and couldn't let anyone near it. So I arrived at Swan Studios in Harlem, and Robert, the sound engineer, started rewinding the tape. And when he did, every single manual edit snapped.
Oh, my. So this is an edited, this was an interview that was done that was then edited. And how did they edit tape?
Well, they had to take it physically and slice it and then with adhesive glue it back together. So each and every time it hit one of these physical edits, it would snap, which for me was terrifying, but for him was just run-of-the-mill. He would just take the two ends, reapply adhesive, and keep rewinding it.
Once he rewound it, what did he do next?
Well, he was kind enough to let me sit in the studio and listen to it as he played it for the first time, and I knew I was listening to something very special.
What made it special?
It was special for me because they're not just talking about the organization that they created. They're also talking about their lives, and they're talking about how they see the world around them and how they see gender. It's all very personal. They're not all towing the same line.
What did you take away from hearing that recording?
I think it reminded me of how young everyone was then. I think the Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera that I've grown accustomed to, they were older by the time the film that I've seen of them, the video that I've seen of them, the recordings that I've listened to from them, they had more time under their belt. And this, it was like they were freshly arrived in New York and just letting it all out.
The quality of the tape you're about to hear in this remarkable and far-ranging conversation is a bit uneven. In addition to a snippet of Jefferson Airplane, you'll also notice hissing in the background during part of the discussion. Anyone who has ever lived in an old New York City apartment will recognize that sound. It's coming from the faulty valve of a steam heat radiator. The first person to speak is 19-year-old Sylvia Rivera. The second is someone named Victor, and the third is Marsha P. Johnson, who was 25 at the time.
Before my mother passed away, like my first 3 years, my mother used to dress me in girls' clothes, and my grandmother kept on buying like little blouses and girls' slacks until about I was 6 or 7 years old before I went into school. Then she started dressing me in boys' clothes. During that period, that's when I discovered my homosexuality, was like, you know, watching television and placing myself in the role of the female, or just placing myself as another boy in the male's arm, and the man that was playing such a fantastic love role in the television. And I found when I left home at 11 was really when I went into transvestism and makeup, hustling in the streets and the games, I guess, whatever you want to call them.
My experience is different from Sylvia's. I did it all secretly because if my mother would catch me, she would forbid it. And by the time I was 5 years old, I knew enough that to do these things secretly. So I used to, when no one was around, to put on makeup and wear women's clothes I can get my hands on. But otherwise, I grew up quite masculine. I went to school, I played baseball, I went to college, and so on. And I even grew a beard and was a revolutionary. I did time in jail for pacifist demonstrations. And just recently, I decided, what's you know, why not wear the clothes I prefer to wear? Why, you know, I was all this time I was living a masculine role that I didn't really prefer, or at least I didn't prefer to do it permanently. I preferred the times to be feminine. Women's lib people feel that women are forced to take certain roles which are unacceptable to them, and they want to break out. Now, I've often felt the same way about being a man, that I've been forced to take certain roles. Number one, something as unimportant as the clothes I have to wear. Men's restrictions on men's dress are much more severe than the restrictions on women's dress. Men are forced to look a certain way, and I didn't want to look that way. Then, of course, there's a man has to be tough. He has to have responsibility. He has to take care of people. You know, suppose I wanted to be petted, or I wanted to be taken care of.
As I was growing up, I met a lot of men, but they never appealed to me. you know, too much sexually. I used to try and keep away from him because of my hometown. If you were homosexual, you were out of it. And they would call you all kinds of names. And then when I first came to New York, I was 17 years old. That's when I started getting kind of more like a transvestite. I started out with makeup in 1963, 1964. And in 1965, I was coming out more. And I was still wearing makeup, but I was still going to jail just for wearing makeup. In 1969, I started wearing female attire full time. Usually I wear a short dress every day of the week. I just don't put on much makeup or anything until after dark because it draws too much attention. If I were to wear a lot of makeup in the daytime, they might think that I was a male. But if I wear little makeup, they think I'm a female and they just let me ride on by. And if I wear a lot of makeup at night, they automatically know I'm female. They really can't tell the difference about me because I'm on my way to be a sex change. I have hormone treatments and my bust is it's a small bust, but it's a nice handful. And they feel that nice handful and they automatically go under the illusion that I might be real. From going into hormones, I've gotten so that I kind of just like heterosexual men. And if I was to marry a male, it would strictly be a gay male. Because I don't care if a heterosexual man is a husband. I can't think of the word, but it's too masculine for me.
Too oppressive. Be more realistic about it.
I could always talk like a woman. I could always act like a woman. I could always do things that women would do because I was raised by my mother. Like I could wash, I could iron, I could cook, I could sew. I can,
That's very
oppressive. Well, that's what they're good for doing.
Ooh, stop.
That's what women do. That's what my mother always did. Well, some women don't do that, but my mother was poor. She had to do it all herself.
I, as a person, don't believe that a transvestite or a woman should do all the washing, do all the cooking, and do everything that was forced on by the bourgeois society and the establishment that women have to do this. I don't believe in that. That's all a lot of baloney. If you have a lover or you have a friend that you really care for, you split everything down 50-50. If you don't feel like doing it, you just don't do it. Let him do it. Because this is what we're all trying to get across. Men are oppressive. They just oppress you in all different ways.
All transvestites have a very feminine image. Some of it is a Marilyn Monroe type of sex pot. Some of it is a motherly figure. Mine was a fashion model.
Girls have always told me that they have trouble at night. Men bother them.
I
never believed them until I went out in the street in drag for the first time. And the first time I decided to be best at night, people couldn't see me very clearly. I went out and men start following me and they make lewd remarks to me in my ear. I got so scared.
I've met many of men through my hustling experiences that were transvestites but were married. They were supposed to be heterosexual male. At this time, like, I would be dressed in unisex clothes and flamboyant hairstyles and makeup and the whole bit, you know, and they would come up and proposition me. And I was, you know, they would like to wear my female clothing or either go with me to a store and help them shop so they can come to my house and I show them how to dress and put on the makeup and whatnot. They would just get their kicks, their sexual satisfaction by being in female clothing. Like, I never knocked them. I just don't understand it. I knew a person that was female impersonator on stage, transvestite, and she was forced into coming out to the public and saying, well, I'm a heterosexual male, not a homosexual. I think if these men would get their heads together and start
facing this. And it's really beautiful because it's like the same thing a homosexual transvestite has to go through with telling their family. Like, my grandmother completely freaked out for a number of years until she just recently has to be satisfied that I'm going to be my way. And then now she calls me Sylvia, I'm her dear granddaughter, I'm all this, you know. Society keeps on saying, you can't do this because this isn't your role. Who is to tell who what role we're supposed to take? I was at a demonstration when the gay people charged the United States with genocide. And this person wrote a paragraph or more, you know, short thing on when we, the street people and transvestites, appeared on the scene. So right away he throws everything on me and he starts off, Mr. Ray Rivera. Mr. Rivera likes to be called by his transvestite friends as Sylvia. This is very oppressive. Everyone calls me Sylvia. My name is, I've had this name for 9 years. Straight or gay, even on my job, the women that I used to work with called me Sylvia. And like, it's not just transvestites that call me Sylvia or consider me or treat me as she. This is what, people respect you. This is respect. Like, Marsha was written up in the same article, a black male transvestite. Why does he have to say what you want? Just say transvestite. Do not, is that not he, or if he doesn't want to put down she. Because I think whatchamacallit, if he's going to write, he shouldn't classify people. Just say transvestite. The transvestite brigade showed up or whatever. But he did very wrong, like, to classify people like me as Mr. Ray Rivera. Because, like, he knows me from Gay Activist Alliance when I first joined there. Like, I was there when GA first started, 4 months, when it was 4 months old. And, like, I made a phone call from Jersey. Like, do you accept transvestites? At that time, I was still using the word drag queen. I said, do you accept drag queen? Sure, come on down. So my friends and I tipped down there to the meeting from Jersey. And we walk in, we took a peek. Here was nothing but butch male homosexuals that always oppressed transvestites. And we were very flamboyant with the makeup and everything. You know, tipping in, you know, really looking beautiful. So, like, we walked away, we walked up the block, and we came back, and we peeked in some more. And said, no, let's go home. We walked about 5 blocks and said, no, let's go in and freak them out for the hell of it. So we walked in, and I come, what's your name? At the table, you had to write your name. I said, my name is Sylvia. He says, what is your name? I said, I'm Sylvia. He says, well, we can't accept that name. So I wrote down Sylvia Lee Rivera in parentheses. I have the habit of putting Ray Rivera, my real name. Even butch identify, even men, you know, homosexual males that are dealing with their sexism are always discriminating against transvestites. Because, like, they just can't, that we're threatening their masculinity. This is the way they feel. I've never been to bed with a woman. I would never marry one. I would never consider even the thought. But I, as a person, could never see myself going to bed with a woman.
Oh, sorry.
Women terrify me as far as that goes. I'm sorry. I'm being realistic. I'm actually, like, I love to be around women. I can't stand to be in a room full of males because they get me uptight. I get very uptight. Like, you know, they look at me and, like, you know, I get very uptight. And, like, with women, I'm more free, you know, like, they understand. A woman seems to understand because you're gay and you're a transvestite. They understand you more than a male does, and they won't ridicule you that much. I'm dealing with my own problems. Like, self-discipline is like trying to deal away with using the term Miss Thing or drag queen. Like, before, when he called me Miss Thing, I had to hit him because I don't like it. Mary, we got to get rid of that. It's very oppressive.
Do you ever go to drag balls?
I've been to two. I don't like drag balls. I don't believe that, like, I don't believe in competition. And, like, everything there's competing against each other. It is, like, if you feel you should have won the first prize, the first trophy, grand prize, these these break into fights. All this violence, like what you call it. I believe in fighting violence, but got to go out and beat up a pig or something, but don't beat up your sisters for the reason because you thought you made a better gown than she did and you should have this trophy.
Both Sylvia and Marcia remained very visible participants in the battle for equal rights in New York City. They're remembered today as iconic and pioneering trans activists. Marsha P. Johnson died in 1992. She was 46. Sylvia Rivera died 10 years later at the age of 50. To learn more about their lives and Star House, have a listen to Making Gay History's 3 episodes featuring my 1989 interviews with Sylvia and Marsha. Many thanks to everyone who makes Making Gay History possible. Senior producer Nahani Rouse, producers Josh Gwynn and Andre Bellido, deputy director Inga Dataya, audio engineer Jeff Town, photo editor Michael Green, and our social media team, Christiana Pena, Nick Porter, Daniel Lorenko, and Will Coley. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman and our founding editor and producer, Sarah Burningham. Our theme music was composed by Fritz Myers. A big thank you to our researcher, Brian Faree, for unearthing the Star interview you just heard, and to Liza Cowan, who recorded it back in 1970. After her stint at WBAI, Liza went on to write for Cowrie Magazine and later became editor and publisher of Dyke, a quarterly. Today, she's an artist and graphic designer. You can find her work at smallequals.com. Making Gay History is a co-production of Pineapple Street Studios, with assistance from the New York Public Library's Manuscripts and Archives Division and the One Archives at the USC Libraries. This podcast has been made possible with funding from the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Calamus Foundation, Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, the Small Change Foundation, Irwin and Andrew Press, and our listeners, including Rob Darrow. Thanks, Rob. Stay in touch with Making Gay History by signing up for our newsletter at makinggayhistory.com. Our website is also where you'll find previous episodes, archival photos, full transcripts, and additional information on each of the people and stories we feature. So long, until next time.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll
have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh. Can you press stop?
Data are data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Super. Pas pire pantoute. Numéro 1. Ça roule. Bien, merci. C'est cool. Comme sur des roulettes. Ben correct. Quand on se fait demander comment ça va, on dit souvent que tout va bien, même si c'est pas toujours le cas. Si ça ne va pas, parlez-en. Pour trouver de l'aide, appelez InfoSocial 811. Parce que parler, c'est commencer à aller mieux. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Ici Sandy Duperval, vous écoutez Les Beaux Sons avec Nathalie Di Palma sur les ondes de CKUT 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir, on passe la prochaine heure avec nul autre que Sandy Duperval. Vous la connaissez sans doute comme DJ et auteure-compositrice-interprète ou encore comme porte-parole de Fierté Montréal. Elle est impliquée dans la lutte contre la lesbophobie. Elle est aussi gouverneure à la Fondation Émergence depuis 2020. On va parler de son parcours et de son premier EP en français, Ad Vitam, qui est sorti à l'automne 2021. Elle est déjà venue nous voir en studio il y a plusieurs années. C'est un réel plaisir de la retrouver ce soir. Bonsoir, Sandy Duperval, et merci beaucoup d'avoir accepté l'invitation.
Bonsoir, merci beaucoup.
On va commencer par le début. Tu es née à Montréal, dans le quartier Saint-Michel.
Oui.
Tu es très proche de la communauté haïtienne et tu as commencé à chanter très jeune, presque en même temps que tu as appris à marcher.
Oui.
Qu'est-ce que tu retiens de ton enfance en lien avec la musique?
Je pense que honnêtement, la musique, ça a été la fondation de ma vie. La musique, c'est ce qui nous a gardés heureux, c'est ce qui nous a gardés connectés, c'est ce qui nous a permis d'exprimer aussi nos sentiments. Tu sais, j'ai quand même grandi dans un milieu super religieux, donc on allait à l'église comme 4 fois ou 5 fois par semaine. Puis j'étais enfant unique, donc ça me permettait de connecter avec les gens, de me faire des amis, de rencontrer des gens avec la même passion. Mais